Good morning, everybody, and thank you for that welcome to country. I'm John Lyons, the Global Affairs Editor of the ABC and the author of Balcony Over Jerusalem, which is being re-released this week in light of October 7. I've updated the book to look at what October 7 means for the Israelis, the Palestinians and the general Middle East. This morning, I'm delighted to be joined by Bruce Wolpe. Bruce is a senior fellow at the United States Study Center in Sydney. He's a regular contributor on US politics across media platforms in Australia. You might often see him on the ABC News Channel in the afternoons on Afternoon Briefing with Greg Jennett. He's worked with the Democrats in the Congress in Washington during President Obama's first term. Also, he was on the staff of Julia Gillard when she was the Prime Minister. From 1998 to 2009, Bruce was a senior executive at Fairfax Media in Sydney, which is when I first met Bruce. And he's the author of several books, the latest being, of course, Trump's Australia, with that intriguing title. Bruce, welcome from the United States this morning.
John, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you. Honored to be with you. Congratulations to all the Louise and everyone associated with the festival. John, it's Super Tuesday here in America, so I did the normal thing in Colorado. I had a long snowshoe, and then I went to vote. And they'll be counted tonight, and we'll see where Super Tuesday is leading the country and ultimately the world and its destiny.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I won't ask you who you voted for, but I presume from this book that it was not Donald Trump.
It's on Twitter. Don't worry about it. You'll see it.
Firstly, can you give us an idea? Super Tuesday in America, this looks like the day when Donald Trump will be anointed as the presidential candidate. Can you tell us how it's looking?
The contest has been over for several weeks. I mean, the amazing thing is that Trump came back from January 6th, the insurrection that disgraced him and his presidency. He was impeached because the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, who announced his retirement last week, decided not to vote to convict. There was not a conviction. If Mitch McConnell had voted to convict Donald Trump of the insurrection and trying to overturn the election on January 6th, he would be barred by the Constitution from running. He would be moot. But he's there. And one thing about Donald Trump is he never retreats. He never admits error or wrong. And he goes after all of his enemies. He denies, he denounces, he discredits, he defames. He kept hold of his base, and his base never deserted him. He never deserted them. And he stared down, crushed all of his opponents, including Rick DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who was such a promising alternative to Trump. Nikki Haley, we can get to if you want. And so he has the nomination locked up. And the interesting thing, turning to Democrats for a moment with Joe Biden, is no one challenged him. He wanted to run again. I commend an interview that was just published this week by Evan Osnos in The New Yorker, really lengthy pieces. Joe Biden entered the presidential campaign in 2020 in order to stop Donald Trump and save democracy in America. He defeated Donald Trump. He's the only person who has defeated Donald Trump. And he was not, and seeing that Trump was in the race, he was determined to defeat him again. What's so interesting is that given his age and how that has been a drag on his campaign, not one senator, not one governor, not one member of the House leadership, not one member of the cabinet stood up and said, it's time for you to step aside and the next generation to come. It's an inversion with the Republicans. Republicans have a strong base and they're with Trump. The Democrats have a strong leadership and they're with Biden. The base has real doubts about where Biden's fate, how effective he can be, and whether in fact he will lose. And those are the defining factors in this campaign. Anyway, after tonight, Biden's a nominee, Trump's a nominee.
Well, Bruce, before we get on to Donald Trump, I'd like to follow you up on Joe Biden. He'll be 86 by the time he finishes the next term. Should he win? Nothing against older people. As each year goes on, I'm becoming more and more supportive of older people. More opportunities is what I think. But to be 85, 86 president, it's not like he's particularly young 81-year-old either physically. Sometimes he's talking and he forgets which country he's talking about or where the war is, although people around him say that he has a good team around him. To what extent do you think, for the sake of America, he should have perhaps said, I should hand over to the next generation?
Well, hindsight will be 2020 in November, but he had no lack of confidence that in his abilities and his ability to win and continue what he was doing. And again, no one challenged him in that regard. But nevertheless, I mean, people across the country, everyone looks at him. He walks old, he talks old, he looks old. What's so interesting, though, is that there are no, you know, John, you know better than almost anybody how the press and the media covers leaders. There are no stories from the White House that in private the man doesn't have, he doesn't have it. His mind is not clear. He is unable to discharge the duties of office. And there have been, again, no desertions. And everyone who sees him up close and works with him says, Joe Biden's fine. And he knows what he wants to do and where he wants to take the country. So, but as far as public opinion is concerned, there is a lack of confidence among the American people that he can do this. A sidebar to it, of course, he's running with Kamala Harris. And Republicans are already saying, well, a vote for Joe Biden is a vote for President Harris, that he will never finish the second term. So how do you like that, America? So that's part of the mix, too.
Bruce, one question that I have, and I know a lot of people have a similar question, is a country of 340 million people, it's the strongest military the world's ever seen. It's the most dynamic economy. It produces some of the world's smartest people, best actors. I mean, it's an incredibly energetic country. 4 years on, why have we yet again got Biden versus Trump?
If Biden had done what you suggested and said, okay, I've had a great first term, and in fact, most Democrats believe that he's the most effective president since Lyndon Johnson, certainly on the domestic front, and going back even to Franklin Roosevelt and comparing what he was able to do on strengthen health care, on the environment, support for civil rights, voting rights, and other matters. In other words, a high degree of confidence. If he had taken that advice and stepped aside, you would have had a whole generation of Democrats, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and then going back to the field in 2020, Pete Buttigieg would want to come in, I would think, several senators. It would be a rich field. But he decided not to, and again, because of the support of the party for him, he's not challenged, he's there. Donald Trump, he is a unique character. What he stands for is not unique. American politics goes through cycles. And there are cycles on nativism, on isolationism, on protectionism, and nationalism. And we last saw it in the Republican Party at strength in the 1930s. It took World War II, the attack on Pearl Harbor, to get America into the war to defeat fascism in Germany and in Japan. And in the early 90s, there was a isolationist, nativist eruption by Pat Buchanan against George H.W. Bush, and he ultimately lost to Bill Clinton. So Trump knows how to punch those buttons. He's riding that wave. But he is really a unique figure given his background. 14 years on television saying he was the greatest chief executive in the world in The Apprentice. He was known to millions of people. He was underappreciated. His potency was underappreciated by the political class. But he was embedded in the political culture. And he stands for people who believe that modern life is not delivering for them. We lose in trade deals. There isn't enough manufacturing. There are too many immigrants. Crime is too high. We've lost moral values in education, lost moral values in how we treat each other, incivility, and that the losers are those who have traditionally been the majority in American life. And they feel threatened by it. And Trump says, I'm for you. I represent you. I'm not going to let you down. Send me to Washington. I will kick over the tables and rearrange things. And they respect, his base respects what they believe he accomplished in Washington. They want to see, he says, I'm going to finish the job. And they want him to finish the job.
Bruce, the world has a lot of problems at the moment, sadly, a lot of conflicts. The war in Ukraine has no sign of ending. Vladimir Putin threatening nuclear weapons. We've got the dreadful war in the Middle East, which is starting to spread. No sign of that ending. I interviewed the other day former head of Shin Bet, Avi Dichter, who predicted to me for Four Corners next Monday night that the war could go. He's in the Netanyahu government. It could go for another year or two, he said. Now, with all of these problems, would it be dangerous to have Donald Trump back in the White House?
I think it would be catastrophic to have Donald Trump back in the White House because it would be a complete reordering of the world, notwithstanding that there are immense challenges facing this order of the world. As far as Joe Biden's prospects on the foreign policy front, I mean, he was, you know, Senator Foreign Policy. He was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. Barack Obama chose him to be vice president because of his deep foreign policy experience. But here we are. He stood up for Ukraine and you know, immensely popular, going well, NATO strengthened, the alliance putting Putin on the defensive. But here we are 2 years later, and Putin has at least stabilized the situation and may yet have gains. The Middle East, going back to last September, it looked like there was a new reordering of the Middle East. A Saudi-Israel entente with the other Arab nations in the region, and it was going to change the face of the Middle East for the better. We would all get along together. So we could have, by November, the incumbent president facing setbacks in Ukraine and Middle East policy that is not delivering peace.
But Bruce, let me play devil's advocate to the question I've just asked. Let's reverse it a bit. Donald Trump would argue that under his term, America joined no new wars. Under Joe Biden, three Palestinian children are being killed every hour with American bombs. The war in Ukraine has started and got worse. Donald Trump would argue that for all of his rhetoric and all of that bluster, he was not engaging in new wars. The boss who you worked for, President Obama, there are a lot of killings in the Middle East with a lot of the drone attacks, etc., under Barack Obama. People were gassed in Syria. Obama said he'd do something about it. He didn't. Is it possible that for all of the bluster, Donald Trump would not be as dangerous as people think?
I believe Donald Trump would be more dangerous because of who his friends are and who he wants to do business with and what their interests are. But Trump uses everything that you outlined as a powerful sword to say, I do not want and will not pursue wars. America should not be involved in wars overseas. I want to bring the troops home. I don't trust the alliances that have been built up. And we need to attend to issues in America. So it's America first. And he, let's just go briefly around the world. In Europe, he absolutely wants to weaken, if not withdraw from NATO. With Russia, he wants to build his special relationship with Putin. He says, I can solve Ukraine in 24 hours. Well, I can tell you what will happen. They will get on the phone. He'll say, Vladimir, how are you? Fine, Donald, I'm really great. What are we going to do on Ukraine? And Trump will say, it's yours. And then he likes President Xi in China. What does he want to do with Taiwan? Well, President Xi will say, well, we intend to absorb Taiwan, and it will be as it has always been. We have a one China policy, and so I intend to have Taiwan. Trump says, fine, I want a really great trade deal. Well, maybe that's on the table. He, in the heart of Europe, going to Viktor Orban and his brand of authoritarianism. In North Korea, he had a love affair with Kim Jong-un. He certainly wants to renew that. It was one of the highlights of his presidency. The letters, part of the classified documents case, are the letters he waved in front of people saying, oh, these are my love letters with Kim Jong-un. Well, Kim, the last time I checked, Kim Jong-un has more nuclear weapons today than when President Trump was engaged in diplomacy with him. In Iran, Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran. Iran has more nuclear capabilities today than it had when that happened, and is as strong as we can see in the Middle East as ever before. So, Trump strikes the popular chord. Bring America home. Let's build the homeland. And I'm strong enough. I can take care of our interests. And his base believes him. The question is whether he will win the election, and a majority of the country believes him.
Bruce, just to pick you up on Ukraine there, are you saying that if Donald Trump wins, and my own feeling is at this point that he's likely to win the election for various reasons, do you think that if he wins, that's the end of Ukraine as we know it? Because if he says to Putin, you can have Ukraine or the 20% you've taken by violence, that's the end of Ukraine as we know it, isn't it?
Yes, and it could also be the end of NATO as we know it, and it could also be Putin wanting to reacquire things that were part of the Soviet Empire earlier. So the Baltic states are at risk, Poland is at risk, and those nations know it. I mean, yep. NATO has gotten stronger precisely because of those fears.
So the Republicans say that a vote for Biden is a vote for Kamala Harris. From what you're saying, is a vote for Trump a vote for Putin?
Yes. Da.
You've got to give us some positive news here, Bruce. We're sitting here on this beautiful morning in Adelaide at this wonderful setting. Tell us something positive, please.
You know, the collective blood pressure in Australia really went down on January 21st, 2021. It was just a beautiful day and everyone was happy. There was a normal person in the White House and things were going fine. By rights, Joe Biden, all things being equal, Joe Biden should win the election. And Donald Trump has never cracked 50% approval. He never got a majority in a vote of the two elections. He won because of the Electoral College. But we see, and something very interesting on the Republican side that I'm looking for tonight in the results on Super Tuesday. In the primaries to date, Trump hasn't gotten 100% of the Republican vote. He gets anywhere between 51 and 75% of the Republican vote. That means that, just aggregated, between 25 and 40% of Republicans are not voting for Trump. Now, where are they going to go? Some of them will say, I still hate Biden, I'm going to vote for Trump. Some will say, I don't like either of them, as you started this discussion, and so I'm going to stay home. And some would say, I'm so upset at the prospect of Trump being reelected that I will vote for Biden. So both candidates have an enthusiasm problem. That's the one for Trump. For Biden, the enthusiasm problem is key Democratic constituencies are not excited about him returning as an 81-year-old to be an 85-year-old president. And this hits three key constituencies, at least. The youth voters, young people, they don't want to vote for the old man. I absolutely understand that. Black men in particular look back on the economy under Trump and they believe they did better then than they are doing now. So they're disaffections among blacks. Some of the Hispanic community, there are disaffections because the border is out of control and immigration is the number one issue. And so they have less enthusiasm of many people flooding into the country. And what does that do to their aspirations and where their communities are going? And then we have, of course, the war in Gaza and in key swing states such as Michigan, Arizona, and Georgia. And we saw it in Michigan last week. There's going to be a huge protest vote for absolutely understandable reasons among Arab American voters. And they voted Democratic. Now, I don't think they're going to vote for Trump because he's so anti-Muslim, but will they stay home? So every vote that Biden loses becomes another vote that becomes a vote that has to be made up in other ways. Is this election going to be close? Yes. But as we go from here to November, just looking at Trump, as we say in Yiddish, his mishigas all over the field as to how he comports himself. Legal issues still to be resolved, and a person who, in his presentation, notwithstanding your belief in his America First nationalism and so forth, is more erratic than he has ever been. That weighs on people. And so I still think Biden will win, but it is uncomfortable. It is a very uncomfortable election to behold.
Bruce, I want to talk about Gaza and America. Yesterday, Nathan Thrall here on the panel, on which you were also sitting, he made the point, Nathan, as an American, that never before in American history is a president facing a backlash for being too pro-Israel. Because, of course, the votes that where there are large Jewish communities, as you know, in America, the states are safe states, whether it's Florida for the Republicans or California or New York for the Democrats. But it's in three or four key states where the Arab American vote, as you know, is larger than the margin by which the Democrats hold states like Michigan. How is it that being too pro-Israel is becoming a liability for a US president?
It's because people don't like what they're seeing on the TV screens and people are really angry about it. And that is absolutely understandable.
Is that all Americans, or is that just Arab American voters?
No. If I was a younger person, when I was a younger person, I was against the Vietnam War. It is just so natural for younger people to be against the war in Gaza. I mean, that just makes perfect sense to me. What you also do have, and you pointed out these communities, Arab Americans are coming into their own as a political force. It's happened with other ethnic groups throughout the decades. Jewish Americans were not a force in Congress until the 60s and 70s. And what you have is members who, populations grow, they get elected to Congress, some get come into the Senate finally, and they express the views of their communities. The same thing is happening in Australia. The sentiment for Israel in the United States is still higher than the sentiment for Israel in Australia. But also, with the Jewish vote, it's not just whether you're for Israel. It's also on civil rights. It's on abortion rights. It's on a whole bunch of social issues and where you stand. So I don't think, again, Biden can lose the election because of the expression of these views in key swing states. There are six of them. It's Pennsylvania, it's Michigan, it's Wisconsin, it's Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia. That's where the election is going to be won or lost. And in those smaller constituencies, there can be an outsized power expressed by frustrated voters. And so, yeah, that's how the Gaza war plays in.
On the Arab American vote, though, Bruce, if people in Michigan decide they're saying we won't turn up to vote, which you can do in America, they want Biden to be punished for what they see as the complicity of America in war crimes in Gaza. That's their view. Yet by not turning up to vote in Michigan, they're going to ensure it goes to Donald Trump. How does that help the people of Gaza?
I can't say that it helps the people of Gaza. I mean, the interesting question we started to discuss a little bit yesterday was, what is Trump going to do? What would Trump do in Gaza if he becomes president? It's really unknown. He's really not taken a stand because I think he's it's such an explosive issue. I don't think he wants to touch it and let Biden wear all the weight of it.
Yeah, where does he land on that? Because, as you would know, I think Donald Trump privately despises Benjamin Netanyahu. He's made that quite clear to various people. He despises Netanyahu, yet he's a strong supporter for Israel. The Christian Zionist vote in states like South Carolina, of course, who are very pro-Israel, are pro-Trump. What do you think Trump would do in terms of Israel and the Palestinians?
Also, the Republican Party is more consistently pro-Israel than the Democratic Party, just given the fissures among the Democrats. And that's just very, very strong. And Trump has to be cognizant of that. At the same time, yes, he is not happy with Netanyahu because Netanyahu tries to outpoint him on the media platforms of the world and the world stage and how who's the smartest leader. I do think, though, if you think about who Trump really likes in the Middle East, he really likes Saudi Arabia. He really likes MBS. And I think he wants to be very close with him, in part to counter Iran, but also as to how much can be done to manage a destroyed Gaza and how much can be done to try and ultimately resuscitate something good on the diplomatic front with Israel and her neighbors.
I think you have the view, is it correct, that Donald Trump, but in Benjamin Netanyahu is in fact Israel's version of Donald Trump?
There are a lot of people who feel that way. I mean, Netanyahu, I'll put it this way. I think if you supporting Israel doesn't mean that you support Netanyahu, and supporting America doesn't mean you support Donald Trump. I'll put it that way.
I want to ask you, as a young man, you attended the inauguration of John F. Kennedy in 1961. That was a wonderful moment for the world, for energy, for youth. It was a moment that everybody remembers, that wonderful speech in front of the Capitol building. Can you tell us, how would you describe America then compared to America now?
Kennedy was the next generation that, everything we're talking about with Biden, where's the new generation? Kennedy was it. He was elected at 43 years old. I mean, that's just really young. After Eisenhower, who was seen as an older man in his late 60s. Remember, he was sidelined with heart disease for several, weeks and months during his second term. But Kennedy just represented the spirit of getting the country moving again. And it was also close enough to the end of World War II, in which Kennedy served, was a hero. His daughter, of course, is the ambassador to Australia and who has made all the ties as to President Kennedy's mission as a serviceman in the Navy with the battlefields and with Australia. the country knew what it wanted to do as far as who was, the world was just clearer, right and wrong, freedom and authoritarianism. We defeated fascism, we need to control communism, and also to get America moving again. And so he was, you know, vigor is a word that is associated with Kennedy. It was just very exciting. He was also, you know, we think about Trump and media and his, when Trump is on the media, he just sucks all the oxygen out of the room and completely dominates it. Well, Kennedy dominated media as well. And first of all, there was much smaller media, 3 television networks, the major newspapers, Life magazine, Time, Newsweek, that's kind of it. And he was clever with it. He cultivated ties with reporters. He had press conferences that were intellectually interesting instead of just delivering, you know, the messages crafted in the back room, the talking points that so dominate political dialogue today. He moved around. He knew what diplomacy was. And we saw the effect of it after he was assassinated. Every world leader came to Washington for that funeral because they were invested in him and he was invested in them. In other words, The times were extremely complex, very dangerous. We almost had nuclear war over the Cuban Missile Crisis. But things were clearer, and we had a stronger sense where the country could be united and move forward. And we've kind of lost that.
You say in the book Trump's Australia that Trumpism could never be replicated in Australia. What gives you that confidence?
Several things. Compulsory voting, first and foremost. That is the compulsory voting ensures
that's a popular
that, elections are always going to land center left or center right. An extremist does not win Australian elections. Secondly, the Westminster system. Trump is a blow-in. I mean, anyone can become president of the United States. Not everyone can become become prime minister of Australia. The prime minister is chosen by the majority party in the House of Representatives. That means that Clive Palmer will never be prime minister. Pauline Hanson will never be prime minister. Twiggy Forrest will never be prime minister. So, and
you're committing to that. You're sure of that?
The norms, which is why when Prime Minister Morrison arrogated several portfolios to him, it was such a shock because that had never been done before. It was such a violation. And he was censured, the first prime minister ever censured. By Parliament. And third, you have the Australian Electoral Commission. The person registering to vote in the wealthiest eastern suburbs of Sydney uses the same process as the person in the farthest reaches of the Northern Territory to register to vote. And every vote is counted in the same way. And every polling booth is operated in the same way. So there is no distortion of the will of the people to as far as having their votes counted and applied. So those things are extremely important. And then there are some other things. We have some depoliticized institutions. There's a new chief justice on the high court. Well, that person did not go before a Senate committee and asked how they felt about abortion. You have a new head of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Well, that person never went before a Senate committee asking, what are you going to do about interest rates? So you have institutions that have guardrails on them. So taken together, you have a democracy that is not fragile, it's extremely strong. Morrison wanted to introduce more voter identification. That bill went nowhere. And there has not been any dilution of these safeguards. And that truly distinguishes Australia from the United States. And so I want Australians to appreciate this, to be proud of the democracy that we have. I'm gonna say, I can vote in Australia too, that we have, and see the country can see things through, and that is extremely heartening in a world that is very dangerous.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, when Scott Morrison went off and secretly signed himself in, swore himself in as this minister and that minister, I mean, wasn't that a form of Trumpism? And do you think if someone whispered to Donald Trump that if you win in November, look, why don't you become Secretary of Defence as well and you can become Secretary of Treasury, do you think Donald Trump would like Scott Morrison's idea?
I think they got along famously when they were in power together. They did, and there was an art to it, but then there are some other issues that come with it. We're so closely tied to the U.S., we hear about it so much. So this morning, I happen to listen to the 7 a.m. news on radio, RN Breakfast. PK, if you're here, we listen to you wherever we are in the world. The lead story was it Super Tuesday in America? The lead story wasn't ASEAN's meeting in Melbourne. I don't understand. I didn't get that. I mean, yeah, Super Tuesday is important, but I think what's going on inside Australia is even more important. We have an echo chamber here. So everything that happens over there is in America is heard in Australia, and it filters into the political system. And so a lot of issues on transgender people, that's an absolute direct import from what DeSantis wanted to do in Florida and the theme in the campaign. When the Supreme Court struck down abortion rights in the United States, women in Australia, the prime minister had to make a statement, but women in Australia were saying, is this going to happen here? When there are gun massacres in the United States, people say, well, my goodness, are we going to repeal the gun control laws that we have? And so it does infiltrate the political culture in Australia. During The Voice, there were racist themes in The Voice, and a lot of them came from Trump-style tactics in the United States. And then I think there's a further carryover. I think the descent into vicious anti-Semitism, just attacks on Jews for being Jews, comes because what happened during The Voice, was a strike against the political culture, and how people should debate things. And then the second time it's easier, you know, and the third time will be easier still. And so this does infiltrate the culture and degrades debate, differences, and civility. And so we have to be aware of these things and on guard against them, because it's not, that is not the country that I believe Australia wants.
Bruce, the social fabric in America, do you fear that there could be violence at some point? If Trump does not win in November, then he and his supporters will say it was stolen. If he does win and then doesn't want to leave office, I mean, why would he want to leave office happily at the end of a second term when he didn't want to at the end of a first term? Do you fear that at some point it's going to spill out onto the streets of the US?
There are more guns than people in the United States, and everyone, and on all sides, but everyone is armed. And so, yes, I do expect Trump will never, Trump wins every election. He never loses an election, and because he always says, I won, and his base believes him. Yes, if Trump is defeated, there will be a violence in the streets. Now, how significant it will be and so forth, don't know, but there will be a lot of angry people. But you have to remember, the person sitting in the chair in the Senate to count the electoral votes, regardless of the outcome of the election, is Kamala Harris. It is not Mike Pence, who did his duty under duress from Trump. And so the dynamic is different. The president sitting in the White House executing on the transition is Joe Biden. It's not Donald Trump. So he's not there to pull the levers that he pulled in the lead up to January 6th and leaving office. So yes, we should be concerned, particularly if the election is very, very close, as to what the reaction will be by the losers.
How do you explain that hold, though, that Donald Trump has on people? It doesn't matter how many things he's charged with, what he says, his comments about women even before he was elected the first time. What is the hold that he has on so many Americans?
He is, for everything I say about him and write about him, he is a very canny, very cunning man. He knows exactly what he's doing. He knows how to push buttons. He has, first of all, 70% of Republicans believe that he won the election, and 70% believe that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president. That is his base. And what he says to them, I'd like to just read for just a moment from his campaign speeches, and it explains why he's so successful. What he says essentially is that every law enforcement action against me, every indictment, every trial, this is political persecution. And what has happened is the Democratic president has instructed his Democratic attorney general to instruct their agents to go after me and to indict me and bring me down. And this is the weaponization of justice in order to rig the next election, drive me from the ballot, and it's all political. 70% of the Republicans believe Joe Biden is illegitimate. They believe this. And so what Trump says, and this is from his rally in January, in the end, they're not coming after me. They're coming after you. Either we have a deep state or we have a democracy. either the deep state destroys America or we destroy the deep state. This is, and then he goes biblical on us, this is the final battle. And in New Hampshire, a couple weeks later, he said, every time they indict me, I consider it a great badge of honor. I'm being indicted for you. And never forget, our enemies want to take away my freedom because I will never let them take away your freedom. They want to silence me because I will never let them silence you. And in the end, they're not after me, they're after you, and I just happen to be standing in the way. This is extremely potent, powerful stuff, and it reaches them and they believe it. So all the persecutions, the indictments, they're illegitimate. And they want to take Trump out because they don't want his supporters to win what they are voting for. And this is why no Republican could knock him off, because if you go frontal on Trump and say you're illegitimate, you're going to be the defender in chief, not the commander in chief. They go after him. If by going after him, they're attacking his base. His base will never vote for someone who attacks Trump. That's why he never had a problem being where he is tonight on Super Tuesday in order to command the Republican Party. So that is the secret. But it's so, as with Trump, nothing is hidden. He doesn't have anything in the backpacks that he's going to pull out. I always like to say, for a guy who lied 30,000 times during his presidency, according to the Washington Post, he's the most relentlessly honest politician we've seen in generations. He does what he says.
Bruce, is this the reality of democracy, that a candidate is entitled to come up with their own marketing pitch, to put that to the electorate, and if the majority of Americans go for it, then that's democracy? I mean, what can democracy do about it?
I think people are doing a lot about it, and I think the country is really angry about where it is right now. I mean, I think it's angry on the personal front. How's the economy working? Am I better off than I was 4 years ago? And a lot of people are saying no. I think people are really distressed by the incivility in public life. Trump can get away with all kinds of things, like the treatment of women, and there seems to be no consequence for what he does. He's able to continue with impunity. I think people are upset about that. I think people are unhappy about the deterioration of language and just how people don't work together. I think they're also afraid about their democracy. In other words, the institutions aren't working as they should. In 2000, in 2016, people who did not win a majority of the popular vote were elected president. If Trump wins in November, it'll be the same thing. Most people will vote against him, but he's still the president. Most Americans want gun control. The United States Senate has a rule that says, well, you need 60 votes out of 100, not 51, to pass something. There's no gun control. They want abortion rights. The Senate cannot pass votes, even when Democrats control the House and can pass it. The Senate cannot pass votes, cannot pass a measure on abortion rights. The Supreme Court is not listening to the American people. They repeal abortion rights. They promote gun rights. So the institutions aren't working anymore. And I think people are very upset about that. Now, how you get it back together? Ultimately, these are leadership issues. And I think we'll hear from Biden an appeal to work together on Thursday night here, Friday in Australia, in the State of the Union address. But this is going to take at least the next two presidential elections to work through, whether we have an ascending curve of progress or whether we go even further into the abyss that Trump presents.
I want to throw the floor open in a minute to any questions that people might like to ask, and anyone with a question, please come up to the middle there. And we ask that you keep the questions as short and tight as possible so that it allows as many people as possible to ask a question. While that's happening, I just wanted to ask one more. The special friendship, beautiful friendship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, I'd like to ask you about that relationship. Here you have Vladimir Putin, the war in Ukraine, which I've covered myself for the ABC, the slaughtering of civilians that I've seen in Ukraine, missiles being sent into apartment buildings. When I was there in Dnipro, there was a missile went into an apartment building, 43 people killed, sitting at home on a Saturday afternoon because a 1 kilogram missile went into their building. Clear war crimes. Putin seems to be running Russia like a mafia state. Yevgeny Prigozhin from the Wagner Group upsets him. His plane suddenly drops out of the sky. Alexei Navalny runs a campaign against the way it's operating. He dies tragically last week near the Arctic Circle. How can Donald Trump be so obvious about his friendship with Vladimir Putin, yet the American people, even his base, are not repulsed by that?
Well, I think more than half the country is repulsed by it. Trump just admires authoritarian leaders. He just loves President Xi because Xi has total control over 1.4 billion people, and Putin knows exactly how to play Trump. He clearly has moved into stalemate in Gaza in order to run out the clock on the Biden presidency and reap the rewards that would come if Trump was elected. I mean, Putin is another extraordinarily canny. Democracy is messy and unpleasant to deal with. Authoritarianism is so easy and so clear. And that absolutely appeals to how Trump intends to govern. And one key point on that. He learned a lot of things about why he didn't accomplish everything he wanted to accomplish in the first term. He's learned those lessons. He knows who stopped him. He's not going to let them come into power again. He knows how to pull the levers, use the power of the executive branch to get what he wants.
Okay. Now, our first question, please. Bruce, I hope you can hear there in Colorado. Yes, thank you.
I'm also in America.
Could you speak up a bit, please?
Speak up more?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
No, it's okay.
I'm also an American-Australian dual citizen, and I worry about the previous president getting reelected again. What responsibility does the media have to report honestly about some of these issues instead of just parroting what the previous president says? Analysis, pointing out the things you point out. What about the media, both in America and Australia?
Thank you.
A lot of people feel that Trump is much less accountable under media scrutiny than President Biden is. I think we're going to get a test of what you're saying in the coming months if, in fact, there are, there's a criminal trial coming up in New York, but whether there can be the trial in Washington on January 6th, whether there can be a trial on the classified documents case. A lot of people have said that if Trump is convicted of a felony, that would really give them great pause in voting for him. So we had, and that would be a clearer image of the person that is representing their party. So we will see if these legal processes, if the trials can occur and verdicts reached, whether there in fact there is accountability after that, and that'll be the truth as to whether what you're saying. That'll decide whether what you're saying is true or not.
Thanks,
Bruce. I hope it's not
true. Thanks, Bruce. Next question, please.
Yeah.
Good morning, Bruce. Thank you for your wide-ranging coverage of the state of American politics. One factor which has come to mind, which you haven't touched on, is the use of deep fakes in advertising, in particular through social media to younger voters. I mean, I saw a horrendous-looking deep fake, which was called out on YouTube, of Donald Trump surrounded by happy, smiling black American women. Which was, called out as a deep fake, but I think this is going to be a big factor. I just wonder what your thoughts were on that.
I agree completely. I mean, going back, it was Obama who first dominated social media and really used it effectively in a sort of positive way. And then we had the 2016 elections with the Russians setting up bots and Facebook and really rigging Facebook to deliver for him. And we're in a world where especially young people are getting news from TikTok. In other words, not getting it, unfortunately, John, the audiences are not as big as they should be at the ABC. But so people are getting news from social media platforms. And AI, you're absolutely correct. There's always a lag in regulating and getting a handle on new technology. This is exploding now. I think we're going to see deep fakes all over the place. It's going to take leadership in the media to call out when it's there. And it's going to require people to be vigilant about what they're watching. We do have, though, in the Australian Electoral Commission, there is no First Amendment in Australia, more power to get stuff off the off digital platforms than exist in the United States. I hope they really ramp up their scrutiny of it. But this is a clear and present danger to the functioning of a democracy.
Thanks, Bruce. Next question, please.
Bruce, isn't the secret to defeating Trump galvanising the women's movement? His appointees to the Supreme Court have rolled back Roe versus Wade, and morally he makes Jeffrey Epstein look like Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And yet I've heard almost nothing. I've been following very close, and I've heard almost nothing from the women's movement. I mean, they've only got 4 months to get galvanised, and so far not a peep as far as I concern.
Actually, I think things are much, much brighter on that front than you're seeing right now. Because after the decision on Roe, the women's movement did explode. And in fact, in several respects, there was supposed to be a conservative wave in the last election, the midterm elections, the first elections after Roe. In 2022, the Republicans barely captured the House. The Democrats kept control of the Senate. And it was because of women especially voting in those contests. In Republican states, Kansas, Ohio, Kentucky, there have been referenda on their state constitutions to protect abortion rights. And by the way, isn't it amazing what France just did in writing into their constitution freedom of choice for women, an outstanding act that I hope inspires people around the world. So in these Republican states, by margins of 60%, these protections for abortion rights were done, but 60% of the vote. So the movement is alive. It is out there. It is effective. It's also terrifying the Republicans. Look what in Alabama, the state legislature outlawed IVF. Well, that was one embryo too far, and people went nuts in reaction to it. And that has now been repealed under state law. Women's rights works extremely strongly in the United States, and it could be the not-so-secret weapon that really helps Joe Biden in November.
Thanks, Bruce. Next, please.
Could you clarify the rules? If Trump is convicted of any or all of the 91 counts that he's been charged with, can he still be president? Can you be convicted of felony and civil trials and be ruling from prison?
Yes, they're putting special telephones into a prison in Lexington, Kentucky right now. But yes, you can't. There is no constitutional bar to the president being in office. You know, it's unprecedented how many times we use the word unprecedented to describe what is occurring in the United States. And how that would be handled, a convicted felon being sworn in. You know, when you take the oath of office, I solemnly swear to faithfully execute the laws of the United States, not faithfully destroy the laws of the United States. We'll see.
Thanks, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you very much for your talk. How can the Democrats woo back the Arab voters in the swing states, and are the Republicans also trying to do this?
Well, I'm sorry, I couldn't quite get the question.
Sorry, I said, how can the Democrats woo back, attract the Arab voters in the swing states, and are the Republicans also trying to do this?
The Republicans would like it or not so interested in it to a degree. I mean, clearly, if there is a real ceasefire that holds, if the attacks in Gaza stop, if rebuilding begins, if there are some signs of life in something other than this horrific war, yes, then I think the intensity of concern about Biden and the conduct of the war to date will emerge. But I do think this is a wrenching situation that will stay with people for a long, long time. So there might be some, but this is the roughest terrain he's faced as president.
Next question, please.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks very much for a great talk. Just wondering, if Trump does get elected, do you think there's enough checks and balances in the American political and legal system to stop moving towards authoritarian state and becoming a dictator?
Yeah, I mean, What do we need to watch for? We need to watch for if there are rulings in the Supreme Court and Trump simply disobeys them. We need to watch for laws passed by Congress that Trump ignores. And I think what he will do, just as a tool, is to issue executive orders across the board on the policies that he cares most about, such as immigration in particular and crime. So immigration, he's already said, as I said, you know, he is the most relentlessly honest politician in generations. He intends to have the biggest deportations in American history. He will start rounding up people and then just kicking them over the border. And on crime, he wants to take the military. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, told Trump he's not going to do this. He's going to order the military to send troops into the streets of cities to put down civil insurrection, or what he sees as civil insurrection. So he will do things. People will take him to court. The courts will, you know, take time to do it. And in the meantime, he will implement his policies. In other words, we're not going to have three branches of government. We're going to have one branch of government. And it's going to be the Trump branch.
Next question, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Bruce, for your comments and valuable insight. I'm an American citizen, and I'm deeply concerned about this upcoming election. Could you comment on the 2025 project that's been in the works for a long time, probably manufactured with the Heritage Foundation? I think some of the, it's a 900-page manifesto, as you know, but it's some valuable points that are out there that the Republicans would like to put in place if they win the White House. Thank you.
This is a really interesting question. What's interested me is that Trump burned a lot of people. There were a lot of people who went to work for Trump in the first term because they said, I can't stand him for all the reasons. He's gross and disgusting. But I'm a patriot, and so I'm going to take this position of responsibility under President Trump in order to be to make sure that things are going to be okay and we won't go off the rails. Those people are now on the outs. And they say, and they're never Trumpers, and they're not coming back. But there are a whole bunch of other people who never left the reservation, and there are groups such as the Heritage Foundation and others who have thought very carefully. If he comes back, this is our chance. This is the opportune moment for victory in the culture wars, and victory in the law enforcement wars, and victory for victory for our side on the domestic battlefields. And so, yeah, they've put together whole agendas of what to do with the executive agencies, who to staff them, what to propose to Congress, what executive orders. And they've been working very quietly, very diligently. Fortunately, we have good reporting and these stories are out so people can appreciate it. So in the end, another reason why I think that Biden will be aided by this, the extremism of the Trump movement is going to be a focal point of Joe Biden's campaign. He says, and that's not America. And the question is whether America agrees that that's not us.
Next, please.
Hi. Thanks for being here. Just a small question.
Almost.
I don't mean it to be laughable, but is there any truth in political advertising legislation in the United States?
No. The First Amendment enables people to say virtually almost anything. The policing of ads, very limited. The other thing under the First Amendment is that it's not just speech which is free, but it's also money that is free. In other words, all controls on campaign spending were erased by the Supreme Court because the giving of money is seen as an act of speech, and that should not be constrained. In Australia, as I said before, we have more vigorous oversight of the political content of ads and more ability to control the flow of money into campaigns. I'm not so much against the flow of money and how much money, but I sure as hell want instant disclosure. I mean, if I use my Visa card, I can go online, you know, within minutes and see that it's on my bank statement. Well, why can't we have instant disclosure of all political contributions so people can see? And since everyone votes, they have an ability to reach a judgment as to whether they support this person or not. We really need that.
Next question, please.
My question relates to Trump and AUKUS. At one of the early sessions of Writers Week, AUKUS was referred to as Australia's worst ever defence decision. is there any likelihood that Trump would do us a favour by pulling out of AUKUS, by stopping the sale of American nuclear-powered submarines to Australia?
I think I consulted with a lot of experts in foreign policy, people who served in both governments on both across political parties in positions of power in Washington and Canberra, and asked them about AUKUS. And it's, and I put what they say in my book. Trump, among his attributes or his character traits, he's transactional. He looks at everything as a business deal. So he'll look at AUKUS and say, is this deal good for the United States? Is it good for us to export this technology? And then he'll look at the contracts. Well, how much is Australia paying? Should they pay a little bit more? He'll look at the jobs. Where are the jobs being created? Are they being created in America or in Australia? What does China think about it? And so this, it all becomes a factor. And it's not based on principle. It's based on America first and American self-interest. That may result in disruption to AUKUS. Now, in anticipation of this, I think a lot of people who believe in AUKUS and want to see it through are putting in place some safeguards, if you will, as to the limits of what a president can do on it. But what the issue that you raise is going to be a prime focal point of discussion if Trump, as soon as Trump is president, if he is.
We've got time for one last question, please.
I'd just like to put a slightly alternative view to you. If I could read very quickly a commentary from the media yesterday. The Democrats gaze out from their Ivy League casements and Hollywood balconies on a hinterland of racists, bigots and fools, fed a diet of misinformation by right-wing media. From those secure perches, they don't see people who feel betrayed at home and abroad by successive leaders, American communities battling devastating health and financial crises, workers whose income have failed to keep pace with those costs. Never having grasped how validating it is for Americans to hear some who get this, Democrats think they can put him down with ease. My question is there perhaps any sense of a growing view among Democrats that they may have some role in creating and maintaining Trump? And do they need to shift their perspective and change to resonate more closely with the American people?
Democrats saw that, felt that after Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. They feel she shouldn't have lost, but she lost because of arrogance in that campaign that was not reaching people who felt that the system, the order at the time, was not delivering for them. A lot of people still feel this system under these times under Joe Biden are not delivering for them. But I do think, again, most of the country did not go nuts in 2016. Most people voted for Hillary Clinton. Joe Biden has, if he stands for anything, he stands for working people, good union jobs, health care, a clean environment, the middle class, and building it. So the question is, A, is he effective? And B, are people listening? And that's his challenge for November. But the issue you raise, absolutely legitimate, is a very strong political force.
Well, Bruce, I think we're all sitting here in Adelaide a bit horrified about the future now.
I'm so glad I could do that for everybody in Adelaide. I'm really, my apologies.
Before we go off and have a coffee, can you tell us something good about America or Americans, please? We need something.
First, I'm going to have a triple vodka, okay? So that'll be all right as far as dealing with this. The country has not lost the dream that it's had from the beginning of being distinctive in the best way. A country for all Americans and to bring peace, security, stability to the world. That's still the mission, but it's one hell of a challenge to deliver on it. These are really difficult times, really divisive times, and it hurts, and there's no end in sight. So we have hope and we have doubt, but I hope hope prevails.
Well, thank you, Bruce. You've been wonderful today, as has the audience here. So please thank Bruce Wolpe for your great contributions this morning. And thank you, everybody, for the session.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank
See you, Bruce. So much.